This is The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. What if the problem isn't uncertainty, but our inability to live with it? Today on The Mountain Life, bestselling author and journalist Simone Stolzoff joins us to explore why, in a world that demands answers, learning how not to know may be one of the most powerful skills we can build.
Drawing from his new book called How Not to Know, Simone unpacks the psychology behind our discomfort with the unknown, the hidden cost of our obsession with certainty, and practical ways to become more resilient, creative, and adaptable in uncertain times. Simone, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was thinking this morning, I've already checked the weather a couple of times, and I was sort of pondering this notion of uncertainty, and I thought, a good place to start would be just don't check your weather app. You know, be uncertain about the weather. Isn't it okay? In the end, it doesn't matter, but...
And they're so frequently wrong. So
so why do we do it? But, you know, there's a lot in life and in our work worlds to feel uncertain about. What do you talk about in terms of what are these things, the big things?
Well, there's both sort of macro uncertainty and personal uncertainty that I think is coming together right now in this moment. So in terms of the macro sense, there's this really interesting study that looked at global uncertainty over the last 40 years or so. And they found that the five highest measurements all occurred in the last 5 years. So between the pandemic, these wars overseas, shifting tariff policies, a tight labor market. But then there's also the personal uncertainties that we carry every single day. And so in the midst of all of this global uncertainty, our tolerance for uncertainty is also in decline. Maybe this is the reason why you're checking the weather app so much. I think it's a good stand-in for the people that need to look at the restaurant menu before they go to the restaurant, or people who want to watch the movie trailer before they go to the movie. It's not just that the world is more uncertain, it's that our ability to tolerate this uncertainty is in decline. And so many people are feeling anxious and unmoored as a result.
Well, that all makes good sense, what you say, but what has changed with us culturally, in our society, with technology, whatever it is, what has changed to make us less and less tolerant for uncertainty?
I think the big thing is the rise of the internet and mobile phones in particular. So whereas maybe 10 years ago, I might have been okay not knowing, say, the name of a given actor, now I feel this almost involuntary need to reach into my pocket. I think our phones do two things. One is they create the expectation that answers should be readily available, that if you just sort of swipe down to check the weather app, it'll always tell you exactly what the weather is going to be in 5 minutes, in 5 days, in 5 months. The second thing it does is it robs us of the practice of sitting with what we don't know. Developing uncertainty tolerance is a skill that we build through exposure. And now that we can track our children's every movement, we can track global crises on the other side of the world, we're losing that skill as a society.
I love how you point out in your book that it's wired in us to associate certainty with safety, and how that's kind of part of the evolved human self. But there are some people, especially creative people, who are especially tolerant naturally of uncertainty. Can you share a little bit about why uncertainty is especially helpful with creative tasks?
So if you want to produce anything original, it requires you to get to a point where you don't know exactly where you're going to end up and to persist. So whether you're a scientist looking to make a new scientific breakthrough, or an entrepreneur looking to start a company in a new industry, or an artist trying to produce real original work, it requires that tolerance to get to the point where you might not know exactly where you'll end up and to keep going. I like this quote from the musician Brian Eno. He says that, "I want to make music unlike any music that I've ever heard before." And when we're intolerant of uncertainty, that's when you might go for the safe route. You might create something that's derivative or something that's similar to something that you or someone else has produced in the past. But so often we frame uncertainty as a threat, when in actuality, uncertainty is also the birthplace of possibility. It's the place from where all new original things are born.
Absolutely. I could not agree with that more. Well, just to get a little foundational, why do we feel that Why does uncertainty make us so uncomfortable?
You can think about it biologically. So an ancestor of yours is in the jungle. They hear a rustling in the bushes. If you don't know the source of that noise, it could potentially be lethal. And so our brains are wired to seek certainty because it makes prediction easy. It allows us to anticipate what's to come, and it makes us feel safe and secure. The problem is, because of this natural tendency to favor certainty, we see a lot of false positives in the world. We grasp for certainty even when it doesn't exist. I think that tendency can explain a lot of the susceptibility to conspiracy theories, the sort of punditry on the TV that's always telling you exactly who's going to win the election or when the war is going to end. We have this desire to seek certainty even when it doesn't exist. And that is the folly. That is when this comes to a head, when our notions of what we think is going to happen don't actually bear out in reality.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with journalist and author Simone Stolzoff, and we're talking about his new book, How to Not Know. Simone, I wanted to tie this into maybe a TED Talk of yours that I saw, and also to your last book, The Good Enough Job. I think I'm in this milieu where there are a lot of people thinking about retiring, and there's so much uncertainty about retiring. And I think the uncertainty, a lot of it lies in this concept of identity, of who we are, and our identity is tied so much to our work. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting tie into the things that you talk about, because if we can be more uncertain, I believe, about what our future is holding, if we have a full and meaningful life in lots of different settings, not just our work setting, which tends to be our identity quite often. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, so my first book was about how work has come to be so central to Americans' identities and reasons for being. And the central argument was that when we diversify our identities, when we are able to find community, meaning, purpose in aspects of our life other than work, it creates a more stable foundation. Similar to how an investor might benefit from diversifying the stocks in their portfolio, we too benefit from diversifying these aspects of our identities. I think one of the best cases for it is that your job might not always be there. So I don't think there's anything wrong necessarily with looking to work as a source of identity or meaning, so long as it's not the sole source of identity and meaning. I think this is what a lot of people are reckoning with, both people who may have gotten furloughed or laid off during the pandemic, or people who are on the precipice of a transition like retirement. They've put all of their identity eggs in one basket and now are facing the prospect of that changing and wondering what is to come. I also think that this diversification approach is a good hedge against uncertainty. You know, if you think about these different sort of pillars of our identity, if one were to crumble based on some choice of yours or something from the world outside, you can still remain standing tall, so as long as you've invested in other parts of who you are.
You know, you, in addition to being an author and a journalist, you were a design lead at IDEO, the global innovation firm. And it's funny, over the years, we haven't interviewed quite a few people from IDEO. And it makes me think that there's something about the culture in that community that makes really creative people, or it's also creative people coming to work in that realm. But I'm wondering, for you personally, as that kind of creative person, and maybe you were always more willing to put up with, to tolerate uncertainty. Was there some time, some personal experience you had that that made you say, hey, I'm really so happy that I have this tolerance, or wow, I need to develop it more?
Yeah, more the latter. So there's one moment in particular that stands out. When I was about 28 or 29, I was working for The Atlantic. So I was working as a journalist, and a recruiter reached out to me from IDEO to potentially join this design firm. And I found myself at this career crossroads where there's these two potential job offers ahead of me. And it sent me for an existential loop. I could not make up my mind for the life of me. And on one hand, it's like, oh, the agony of deciding between two attractive job offers, you know, world's smallest violin. But on the other hand, you know, it didn't feel like I was choosing between two jobs. It felt like I was choosing between two versions of me. And in some ways, that was the central insight that led to my first book. But the other thing that I learned from that experience was that I was looking for certainty where there was no certainty to be found. How could I have known which job would have ultimately been better for me without having actually worked the jobs? I think that's a tendency that so many of us fall into these days, where we look to try and control the future, or we look to know for certain, whether it's deciding what college to go to, which job to take, who to marry, whether I should buy this house or that house. And I think I often come back to this line that I learned from this psychologist, Rollo May: commitment is healthiest, not in the absence of doubt, but in spite of doubt. And I think that is sort of the skill that I'm hoping readers are able to cultivate by reading How to Not Know. It's how can you make decisions even if you don't know exactly how they're going to turn out?
I love that. In this kind of curated era of our info feeds constantly being responding to the formulas of things we've looked at before, I often wonder if there's just a narrowing of exposure of things that we're exposed to. And I think in one of your talks, you mentioned something about going to see a movie without having seen the trailer. And I think about that a lot with reading books that I haven't read extensively about. And the other day, as an example, my son and I ended up pulling up the movie Apex, which I just heard secondhand that was just this great new movie on Netflix. I knew nothing about it. And it was a very suspenseful thriller kind of show. It was scary as crap. And I had no idea. I didn't know who the villain was. I didn't know who the hero was. And it made for such a fantastic viewing experience. And I thought, I have to do more of this. I want to pick more books off of the shelf of the library and not go in looking for the thing that I know already is probably in my feed as something I will enjoy. How are there other strategies that we can take on in order to kind of broaden or strengthen our tolerance for uncertainty?
I love that example because I think it's a good metaphor for how we live our lives. You know, uncertainty is uncomfortable. I don't want to deny the fact that uncertainty by design makes us feel some dissonance. And yet imagine the alternative. Imagine if everything in our life was already written. We were just sort of on a conveyor belt going to a known destination. You know, every movie would have a spoiler. Every first date would not have the sort of butterflies of maybe so. It is the uncertainty that creates surprise and delight and serendipity. And so I'm not advocating for sort of going full hog and only exposing yourself to uncertainty, but I think both are important elements to a meaningful life. You know, one piece of advice I often give people who are struggling with uncertainty is to find your anchors. The research shows that when we are certain about some aspects of our life, it makes it easier to hold uncertainty in others. Maybe an anchor is your commitment to a place or to a person or to a set of values. But when you know those things that will be sort of the steady boulders amidst all of the changing winds, it allows you to be able to do a little bit more exploring. There's some really interesting research that shows when we sort of micro-dose uncertainty, when we consciously expose ourselves to uncertainty in small contained environments, like going to that restaurant you've never been to before or taking a new route to work, it actually rewires our brain to get better at handling uncertainty in the bigger questions of our lives as well. So I think in terms of, you know, choosing the book off the shelf or watching the movie without the trailer, you don't always necessarily need to do that. But by doing so, you are telling your brain that I can be in an uncertain situation and it might work out all right.
For sure. I like that anchoring idea. I think I read years ago that Barack Obama had like all the same suits because he wanted to limit the amount of decision making he needed to do in some areas of his life to free up that energy for making more complicated decisions. And I think that's wonderful. You also mentioned three certainty traps in your book. Could you share what those certainty traps are?
Yeah, so I originally called The Certainty Traps The Horseman of Delusion, but
The Horseman of Delusion, I like
my
it.
editor thought that was a little too highfalutin. But basically, they're things that trap us into looking for certainty that might lead us astray. So the first is comfort, our desire to feel comfort with our lives. I think the canonical examples here are maybe someone who's in a relationship that they know isn't quite working for them, or in a job that they know isn't quite right for them, but would rather sort of the devil they know. They would rather stick with the status quo than have to expose themselves to uncertainty, even though that uncertainty might reveal something that's even better for them. The second is hubris, which is our tendency to think that we know more than we do. And I think especially in sort of a business context, this gets in our way all the time, our inability to admit what we don't know. But on the other side of hubris is the humility it takes to be able to say, I'm not sure. And that becomes sort of the precursor to learning and growth. And the last is control, which we touched on briefly, but I think this is why people are so inclined to say, check the weather app 5 times a day. We have this feeling that if we could just plan exactly how the relationship is going to go, or exactly how our career might look for the next 10 years, then we will be okay. Then we will feel safe. The problem is we can't control the future. By definition, anything that hasn't happened yet, there is no certainty about that. And so on the flip side, I think about acceptance, sort of being able, in the words of the Serenity Prayer, to notice what we can control, notice what we can't control, and have the wisdom to be able to know the difference.
That's really nice. I think of when I personally don't want to go into uncertainty, a lot of it has to do, and I'm trying to figure out where it fits in with the three traps, comfort, hubris, and control. It's probably control. That I think, well, if I do this and if I allow myself to go into this thing that I'm very uncertain about, what if I don't like it? That's the big thing. Like, what if I don't like it? What if I find it boring? What if it's not appealing to me and I view myself in this certain way that I am someone who would enjoy this sort of thing and then I don't? I guess that would be control, right?
Yeah. I mean, think about what's sometimes called the explore versus exploit trade-off, which is when we know what we like, we can exploit those preferences. Imagine you are creating a playlist for yourself. You could just add songs that you like again and again and again. But the risk for too much exploitation is that you can overplay the song. You can get too used to sort of your preferences and they can become a prison. On the other side is exploration. This is consciously exposing yourself to things that you're not sure whether you like or not. And the risk is that you might not like them. But the benefit is that you might discover something that you like that you didn't previously know. And so I think that's sort of a tension. It's not always are you going to be exploring, you're not always going to be exploiting, but how can you find a good balance so that you are both taking advantage of what you know you like and exposing yourself so that you can expand the map of what your preferences are.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. Well, I have a loved one, someone in my family who has dealt with anxiety for a very long time. And one of the things that helps her with the anxiety is to make sure that there is nothing uncertain. If she's looking for, if she knows this job is coming to an end, she's 6 months ahead of time interviewing for new jobs, and it helps quell the anxiety for her. So for someone, you know, if you can sort of look and juxtapose, you know, the uncertainty tolerance with someone who deals with anxiety, where are those areas that you might want to practice a little uncertainty while still anchoring?
Yeah, I spoke to various different doctors and psychologists about this exact question, sort of what is the root of anxiety? And a lot of them point to intolerance of uncertainty as being sort of the core. If you think about anxiety, about is worrying about something that hasn't happened yet. A lot of that comes from your inability to tolerate the unknown, similar to your friend. And this one psychologist in particular, named Mikhail Dugas, said that when we are particularly intolerant of uncertainty, there's two main behaviors that he sees in his patients. One is obsessive information gathering. So we all have a friend who's going to, you know, buy a water bottle on Amazon, but first they have to read every single review and compare 20 different water bottles. And the other is to be incredibly impulsive, to maybe just buy the first water bottle you see. And a more adaptive approach is to do a little bit of both. I think the key is the ability to take action as sort of something that can absorb anxiety. So I think about this in conjunction with climate change all the time. There's this foreboding cloud on the horizon of what the future of the planet is going to be. That has the potential to paralyze you, for your fear to take over, for your discomfort, for uncertainty to keep you locked in place. But the same thing that will help the climate movement is also the same thing that's going to help your anxiety, which is taking some sort of action, being part of the solution in some way. And so I don't think it's necessarily a problem that your friend likes to plan, so as long as she's not letting her fear of uncertainty take over her life. We have these natural tendencies to catastrophize, to think about all the things that could go wrong. And I think one of the things that action does is it allows us to see the clarity over time.
Yeah, I just got back from seeing my son who's graduating or who's finishing his first year of college. And we were having some nice talks when I was with him. And I was kind of asking him to extrapolate into the future about some of the things he might want to do with his life. And he really frankly said, honestly, so many people, including me, don't know if there will be a future that we'll have. We don't know if there will be jobs. We don't know if the climate crisis will have the world here. We don't know if nuclear proliferation will destroy the place. Do you have any encouraging messages for people who are dropping into that hopeless space of inaction?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's really relatable. I don't envy a new grad who's looking for a job in this climate right now. I do think the biggest thing that might help your son and his peers is finding a sense of agency so that they can take a little bit of control back from the universe. So rather than just, say, sending your resume out into the void, is there a personal project that you can work on? Is there something that you can do that you don't need others' permission in order to do? So for example, I get a lot of emails and DMs about people who want to become writers. And the first question I often ask them is like, what do you like to write? What have you written recently? And often people will say things like, well, I have all these ideas for what I might want to write, but I haven't actually written anything. And so my advice is to do it. Just don't wait for permission. Get close, get proximate to the type of work that you actually want to be doing. At IDEO, we used to have this saying, never come to a meeting without a prototype. And I like that way of thinking. I think so often, especially when we're anxious or worried about the future, we can get stuck in our head. We can think about all these different thought experiments about, oh, do I want to be president or would I be better in investment banking, whatever. The best way to find out answers to some of these questions is through the work itself. And so to your son and his peers, you know, it's a hard situation. I want to stand in solidarity with them and also try to find things that you do have control over that you might be able to learn through the doing about whether it is something you enjoy.
I think that's terrific advice. In one of the talks of yours that I was able to hear before we spoke today, you mentioned having met an idol of yours and some advice that he gave you about whether the path to happiness is doing the thing you love and the money and success will follow. In wrapping up our interview today, would you mind sharing that story? I thought it was really powerful.
As I was in a similar place to your son, I was in college at the time as a senior, so maybe a little older, and I was a poetry student, so, you know, a very lucrative career path for me. And I had the opportunity to interview my idol, my favorite writer in the world. His name is Anis Mojgani. And I wanted him to give me this pep talk. You know, here I was about to graduate college, going into the working world for the first time. And so I asked him, you know, Anis, how do you feel about the mantra, do what you love and never work a day in your life? And he said something that I'll never forget. He said, you know, Simone, I think some people do what they love for work, and others do what they have to so they can do what they love when they're not working, and neither is more noble. And I think that last part is key. I think we live in a society that loves to revere people whose jobs and identities neatly align. And here was my idol, a professional poet, no less, telling me that, you know, maybe it's okay for your job to be a means to an end. And so I think that's sort of my MO as a writer, rather than pulling to an extreme and either villainizing or lionizing work or villainizing or lionizing AI or saying the future is going to be doom or the future is going to be utopia, is my attempt to help readers develop comfort with the middle path. to develop that tolerance for uncertainty so they can gracefully adapt to whatever the future does hold.
Well said. We've been speaking with Simone Stolzoff, author of a wonderful new book called How to Not Know, and it's just coming out. And this has been such a pleasure, and I just really appreciate this message personally today, and I hope our listeners will as well. Thank you so much for being with us on The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me.